Hello and welcome to the University Radio Nottingham for the Science Show. So today's podcast, we're going to be looking at asymmetry. Why are things the way they are? But before we get onto the topic, let's all introduce ourselves. My name's Daisy Dobrovich and I'm a PhD student studying for a PhD in agriculture and environmental science.
I'm Jamie Rose and I am a first year mechanical engineering student.
I'm Catherine Thomas. I'm a second year materials engineering and materials design PhD student.
And I'm Tom Alcock. I'm a final year PhD student in plant science.
Okay, so what brings us on to the topic of asymmetry? Some of you may have heard that Jeremy the snail has been a bit of a celebrity at the University of Nottingham, and he's famous because he has a left coiling shell.
So is this a really rare trait for a snail to have?
Yes, well, they've estimated it's about one in a million.
Wow. Where did they find this snail?
Oh, well, it's quite funny, actually, because he was discovered on a compost heap in southwest London by a retired scientist from the Natural History Museum. So he knows a thing or two about biology and about snails, right. And he noticed that it was coiling to the left. So he did contact Dr. Angus Davison here at the University of Nottingham because he knew that he had some research on the topic and thought it might be of interest.
Was the guy who found him named Jeremy? Is that why it's named Jeremy?
He was actually called Jeremy after Jeremy Corbyn, who is famous for his left-wing politics. And of course, Jeremy has a left-coiling shell.
That's actually my favourite fact so far about Jeremy the snail. I've been reading these notes for the last half hour.
So are there any issues with this snail being left-coiling instead of the usual right?
Yeah, well, actually, I think the biggest one was the sexual reproduction. So, unfortunately, poor old Jeremy, he had all of his sexual organs on the opposite side to most of the other, well, right-coiling snails' shells. So, actually, he needed mates with left-coiling shells also. But he is a one in a million, so that was actually quite difficult to find.
And did they manage to find any others?
Yes, well, actually, they put a peel out on BBC Radio 4, and this actually was this went worldwide, and they actually found six other left-coiling snails that they were going to try. I believe that at least one or two of them came from Spain, I think they brought in. So they brought two in for him to mate with.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, lucky Jeremy. But unfortunately, not so lucky for him, they put all three snails in together, and his two mates then started to mate with each other, and he was left, you know, out in the cold.
Oh no.
Yeah, so poor Jeremy. But, you know, it's good to know that he did eventually, they then put him in just with one of the snails, which makes sense. You know, you just go for whatever's there. So then he decided, you know, they could, they then mated, and he managed to successfully produce offspring.
Right, and were these all left coiling as well?
No, they weren't actually. They were all right-coiling snails.
Oh, right. But
they do suggest that perhaps it's the mother's genes that determine the direction of the coil. So they're expecting maybe in the second or third generation to start seeing the left-coiling shells in the offspring.
I just love sometimes when you read about other people's experiments. I love the fact they went for putting three snails in at once initially, just because it does read slightly like a really awkward internet dating story.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like most awkward, internet dating stories, it didn't really end in success.
Yeah, but he did at least. There is a half... Well, I suppose is now the time to mention... Oh, we have mentioned that Jeremy's already dead.
Oh. No, I don't believe we have, but for those who are listening, unfortunately, yes, Jeremy, he managed to produce some successful offspring. But then, unfortunately, a few weeks ago, he did die. Okay, so the research into these snails could aid our understanding of body asymmetry in humans. So most of you are probably aware that actually your internal organs are quite asymmetrical. Whilst we may all look symmetrical on the outside, that's not necessarily the case on the inside.
This has baffled scientists for quite a number of years, trying to work out exactly how during development the asymmetry comes about. There's a theory that there's a small pit on the embryo which is called a node, which is also covered in tiny hairs called cilia. These tilt away from the head end of the embryo, start to whirl around rapidly, and what this does is it pushes fluid from one side of the embryo to the other. And then certain other cilia on this side of the embryo start to activate specific genes, and this leads to different proteins being made on one side to the other side.
So yeah, so I think, and this comes into a lot of things in biology, as far as I understand it, with to switch genes on and off, sometimes it can be really subtle factors that do that. So in this case, so it's just the movement of certain
It's literally just
molecules.
The movement of, it's sort of the fluid within the embryo at that point in time, and certain bits of the certain cells detect then this movement, and that causes a whole new set of gene activation.
Cool.
Do you think the fluid would well the other way if it was down in, say, Australia, for example, like
the way the toilets flush?
Yeah.
Haven't they debunked that? They debunked something like
no,
that.
No, they debunked that because you can debunk that in your bathtub.
Because the thing at the equator is true, though, isn't it? Where if you...
If you stand on one side of the equator...
It'll be hot.
The liquid... Yeah, if you stand on either side of the equator, it's probably quite warm.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so, the fluid will drain one way or another way, depending on which side.
More research needed. We'll get back to you, listeners, about... Yeah. Drainage and swirling issues.
Presumably, though, if the cilia did rotate any the other way around in the southern hemisphere, we'd end up with lots of people with reversed organs, though.
Well, actually, funny you should say that. This can actually happen in humans. So it is a birth defect, and it actually affects 1 in 10,000 people, which is quite surprising because that doesn't actually feel... It's not that uncommon, really. So this is where you get a reversal of the abdominal organs. So it can vary in... severity, but you can have, say, for example, someone could have their heart on the right hand side and their left and the right lungs are actually switched over as well. So it's a bit of a bizarre phenomenon. Doesn't usually cause anyone any issues, but it can be a bit of an issue with organ transplants and donation because obviously they need everything switched over a little bit, and it can make sort of some medical treatments quite difficult. So a lot of people have to wear a medical tag saying that, you know, my heart's on the right-hand side. So, of course, if they need resuscitation, it's not going to cause, you know, too much confusion.
You can imagine for ECGs, if you've wired all your sticky tabs up and you're mapping the electrical activity of your heart, if you've done that on the wrong side, you can get some pretty funky results.
By funky, you mean wrong and possibly dead people.
Yeah, this is how I get through my PhD. If I describe results as funky rather than wrong, I get a lot further in my supervision meetings.
So am I right in thinking this occurs more frequently in identical twins?
Well, actually, yes. There is a phenomenon called mirror twins. So they are identical twins. It's about a quarter, actually, of all identical twins are considered mirror twins. So they have the same physical features, but they have the opposite asymmetrical features. So, for example, one is right-handed, the other is left-handed. One of their hair swells to the left, the other hair swells to the right. One will wear their bag on their left shoulder, one will wear their bag on their right shoulder. So it's quite an interesting phenomenon.
So that's really cool that mirror even comes down to one of them being left-handed and the other one being right-handed. So they are literally sort of split down the middle, as it would seem.
Well, yeah. So, you can actually, you know, you can see all the physical kind of aspects, but internally as well, they will have the organs, you know, they have the reversal of the organs as well with the mirror images.
So also I heard that, like, on the outside, if you've got mirror twins, if you've got one with, like, a birthmark on the left side of their cheek, the other one will have a birthmark on the right cheek.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. And I think it kind of also comes down to how they develop as well when they're actually in the womb as the embryos. So it's quite interesting. No one really knows why mirror twins do exist. One theory is that basically when the embryo would split several days after a normal, you know, non-mirror twin, identical twins would emerge, basically the splitting occurs just that little bit too late. Then you get the mirror twins, but then actually when the embryo splits even later than that, that's when you can have the conjoined twins and all the problems associated with that.
So going back to handedness, obviously it's not just mirror twins that can be left or right-handed. Plenty of people are born left-handed. Interestingly, though, in professional musicians, there was a study that found that particularly keyboard and piano players, they had much less asymmetry between the left and the right hands.
Would this matter maybe, like... when they started, say someone started learning at 10 years old and they're already a right-hander, they can read, they can write right-handed, but, you know, say someone, I don't know, picked up a xylophone when they were 2 and started playing, are they going to have...
Yeah, I think the study did highlight the fact that musicians who started much earlier on had far less asymmetry compared to some of the others.
Are there any advantages to being asymmetrical? Why aren't animals, humans, why isn't everything just completely symmetrical? That means, you know, it would be neater. It just kind of makes more sense to me.
Yeah, so we found quite a cute example. Well, if you like crabs, they're quite cute. So the fiddler crab actually have male fiddler crabs, to be precise, have one claw, which is much bigger and brighter coloured than the other one. And basically the fiddler crabs sit in the entrance of their burrows and they wave these massive claws around their heads, and it's a mating signal.
That's fantastic. I didn't really, hadn't heard of fiddler crabs. What a great name.
Another good example of an asymmetric animal is, of course, the flatfish. So things like plaice, they're flatfish, which sort of swim along the ground horizontally as opposed to vertically, which most fish do. And many of them have evolved for both of their eyes to be on one side of their head, which enables them to swim along the floor and still be able to see everything around them, see any potential prey, see any predators, while staying very well hidden.
But surely with natural selection, that would sort of be quite a weird thing to occur, both of the eyes slowly moving round to the front, because you would assume that if they all come from some form of common ancestor, they'd have eyes on different sides. How would they, get slowly, or would they have one on the top and one on the side?
Yeah, it's a very good point, and this actually baffled evolutionary biologists for quite a while. And they had quite a few attacks from creationists saying, oh yeah, exactly what you're saying, basically, that there's no real intermediate. Fortunately, for the sake of natural selection, there was a recent study which found some intermediates in the fossil record, which did have one eye sort of on the top, sort of slowly making its way round to the other side.
Seriously?
Yeah, it's quite an amazing fossil.
Am I right in thinking, so the flatfish is, in theory, just swimming on its side rather than swimming, it's not got its eyes on top, on the top of its head, say like a crocodile.
No. Both eyes are on one of the sides. And this side can vary. It's not always the left or the right side. Different species have their eyes on different sides. And it actually leads to a whole load of new developmental processes. So the skulls end up very twisted.
I just find it bizarre that it would swim on its side. Like, why not just, swim top and bottom? Like, it just seems...
It's just a way of staying hidden in the sand, I suppose, on the seabed.
If it's scavenging as well, like, it would be better if it just sort of lies across the bottom of the seabed, just sort of eats things as it goes,
Although I think quite a few of them are predatory, so they'll actually... So it's not always just about hiding from predators. It's actually about hiding from your prey. So they're sort of skirting along the seabed nice and slow. As soon as they see something they want, they just jump up, snap it up. And that's it. So I just want to mention climbing beans. So these are bean plants which climb up trellises or other more natural things, and they will spiral around whatever they're growing on. Now, there's been a theory that the reason they do this is that they follow the sun as the sun's moving through the sky. And interestingly, it's been theorized that beans in the southern hemisphere spiral around the other way. However, one bean in particular, runner beans, they spiral the complete opposite way to everything else.
But then you say a majority of them do follow that rule. So could it just be that runner beans are just a sort of exception?
Maybe
they're a bit eccentric.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason why it might not be the case for most of them, but just an interesting fact.
So I think we're spiraling a little bit, guys.
Speaking of spiraling, does anyone know if spiral staircases all go the same way, or whether it's a random thing? If you think a bit grand design, is that an architectural feature?
Well, I sort of may know a bit about this. It's actually to do with back in medieval times. So all spiral staircases are clockwise on the way up and anti-clockwise on the way down, because most knights would be right-handed. So if they've got to swing their sword as invaders are coming up the staircase, they want to have as wide an arc as possible, get as big a slash across the enemy as possible. And, so if you're coming down, you want to be going anti-clockwise so that you can just cut straight across them as opposed to hitting the wall.
That's actually a fantastic answer, Jamie. I bet you didn't think he'd have anything to say about that.
That'll teach me not to mess with undergrads.
So another type of spiral, which may well be the most famous spiral, is the DNA double helix.
Ah, actually, well, does that spiral in the same direction, perhaps as a, castle staircase?
So most DNA in your cells forms a B conformation, which is the right-handed helix, but it is possible for it to form a left-handed helix when it becomes a Z conformation piece of DNA, which can happen after methylation, which is a type of regulation of DNA, which may control when different bits of DNA are translated.
Do we know why? Like, in what sort of benefit would it have for it to be spiralling the other way?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, maybe the cells would recognise it differently and then different enzymes might be able to act on it. Just to stop, perhaps the enzymes that function on right-handed helix DNAs, you don't want them messing with the Z left-hand helix-forming DNA segments.
And this is just in humans, or...?
I imagine this is across all species.
Okay. So that's really interesting with the DNA. So we even see asymmetry occurring, you know, on, well, some of the smallest scales, really, in biology, I assume.
Well, actually, we also see asymmetry occurring on an even smaller scale. In fact, we can see it occurring on the scale of baryons and quarks.
So the baryons, speaking as a, you know, non, what, physicist, whatever sort of science you're talking about here, what are they?
So examples of baryons that most people would know of are things like protons and neutrons. So, you know, very simple, just smaller than an atom, but made up of even smaller things.
Ah, okay, right. No, I'm with you now. So the baryon-like asymmetry. So I'm assuming people would have assumed, you know, they should be symmetrical. Like, why is the asymmetry, is it surprising?
Well, yeah, so the thing about baryon asymmetry is that when most people think of, you know, the part, the model of an atom, for example, you think of, we've got electrons, we've got protons, and we've got neutrons. And an atom wants to be balanced in charge, so it has X number of electrons and the same number of protons, and that's the charge is equal. But in fact, we can go even smaller than that. So baryons, which are just neutrons and protons, among others, which are much more complex, they will have anti-baryon counterparts. So you've got a proton and an antiproton, which is the exact opposite in formation to
I see. And do they serve a different purpose? Or,
well, that's the thing. We're not really sure because, to be honest, we haven't really found any antimatter, which is what these would be comprising of. So, because scientists haven't found any antimatter, we go, well, there should be some antimatter. You know, if we've got matter, there should be antimatter. Everything in the universe should be equal. If at the Big Bang, you know, you start with something, there should be equal amounts and everything should balance in the universe.
So is this, does this relate to charge? So I understand an atom will try to be fairly neutral, have the same amount of protons as, let's say, electrons.
So, yeah, this does relate to charge, but not in the charge in the atom, but more in the charge in the entire universe as a whole. You want equal negative antimatter and positive regular matter.
So I'm right in thinking that, so we've got a proton and an antiproton. So am I right in thinking that they can't meet, because if they meet, they'll annihilate each other?
Yes, that is right. And that is actually a very interesting point, because, so scientists obviously want to know, hang on a moment, where is all this antimatter? It should definitely exist. So one of the things that they've done in order to try and find where the antimatter could be in like somewhere in intergalactic space, is they've gone, right, well, if you've got a region of matter space and a region of antimatter space, where they meet, the particles will annihilate, and so you will get a small photon of light, which will have a different wavelength depending on where it's annihilated.
That's fascinating. Have they seen any of this? Does this exist?
Well, that's the problem. With the equipment that we currently have, no. Because, you know, it's
it
just
worth a try.
It's too far away. So scientists have placed boundaries on approximately where they think that these regions of antimatter space could lie. However, judging by like all scientific progress, we're probably never going to see these regions of antimatter space. So to be honest, we've sort of gone, well, there should be matter. Well, there is matter and there should be antimatter. So if we can't see the antimatter in the observable universe, I guess it's just outside of that. So we'll just ignore it.
So bringing the scale back down again from sort of intergalactic annihilation to something a bit, I was going to say closer to home, but it's still very, very small. So I'm a materials scientist, and something that not a lot of people know is actually, especially things like metals and ceramics, everything that we work with is actually from a crystal structure. So like when you think of table salt and you've got a really nice, they form really nice cubes, and a lot of sugars do this as well. Most metals and ceramics will also form these beautiful, really neatly ordered crystals at an atomic level.
Yeah, so these neat, you know, you're describing everything as neat and, you know, things like that. So I'm assuming they're symmetrical?
Well, they really want to be symmetrical, but the fact that they aren't, just because, you know, life, things don't often end up quite as perfect as they need to be, just because things happen in the universe, if we want to tie it back to Jamie's topic. But, yeah, so you'd have, if you imagine, so we call it a matrix, so if you imagine a sort of 3D structure of cubes, where you've got an atom at each point of the cube, you do get these things called vacancies, where suddenly, for some reason, there isn't an atom at one of these points, so you have this beautiful regular structure with just a bit missing.
Okay.
And we also have these things called interstitial seeds, which I think I've said correctly, which is where sometimes, normally an atom is a bit smaller, they can actually fit between the other atoms. So they, it's all this, like, for example, it's all one type of atom, then you get suddenly get this one small one that's just sort of snuck in and fits snugly inside this structure, but isn't replicating any kind of pattern around
the
shape.
Okay, so it's almost like a little speck, you know, in the pattern. Okay.
And the cool thing about these, sort of, they're known as point defects in crystals, are they allow us to do some really cool materials engineering things. So if you think about semiconductors, which I'm not going to lie to you, aren't a material that I know an awful lot about, but basically these work by, they're ceramic materials, and they work by, we can introduce these gaps in this structure, and that allows the charge to move around the structure differently. So you can take a material like silicon, and which is naturally allows very little current to pass through it. So basically the electrons can't move around the structure because everything's too nice and ordered. But you introduce these little gaps and point defects, and suddenly the electrons can move around in certain ways. So you can tailor how much electricity can flow through your piece of material by creating these gaps and these little asymmetries in the structure which allow the charge to flow through.
Okay, so we already see these sort of gaps and that in nature, and are we just kind of replicating some of their uses then for the material, like making materials?
Yeah, so essentially it's more sort of one of those ones where you work out how it works and then you can use it to your advantage. So another area where there's a lot of asymmetry is because all these materials grow in crystals, so if you can imagine as they freeze, they start freezing from a load of different points, and then I have to imagine it all, so all the atoms around that will suddenly freeze in this beautiful regular structure. So you get one grain growing over to your left and one grain growing over to your right, and they'll grow in their beautiful regular structure, but they won't be facing the same way, so suddenly they'll collide with each other, and obviously they won't match up properly.
Yes,
because you've got two different facing,
like two pieces of a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they've all been growing in this nice ordered way, and then suddenly they can't. But this is called a grain boundary, and grain boundaries are massively important in especially metallurgy, which is the science of metals. And there is just, I could go on about this for hours because I'm a real nerd about this. But there's one thing I will draw your attention to, and it is cool because it's involved in jet engines.
Ah, okay.
So these, like a crazy paving patio, if you're going to break, you break down the weakest points. So between, in metals, that's between these grains. So if you imagine the cement in a crazy paving slab, it's much easier to break up all the cement than it is to go through a piece of paving.
Mm-hmm.
Is everyone with me so far?
Yes.
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 Okay. Right. Good. Thank you, everyone. So this leads to problems because even though you may know the strength of that crystal arrangement, right, it's not actually the strength of your material because you've got loads of these little crystal arrangements all at odds with each other. So the weakest point is your cement, your grain boundaries. For things like aero engines, they're really high performance. Obviously, no one wants an aero engine to blow up because when aero engines blow up, really bad things happen, like planes falling out of the sky. Still the safest way to travel, listeners. Yeah, so obviously a lot of money has gone into making aero engine blades, which are the bits that turn around at really high speeds and compress the air. Really good, basically. And they've actually worked out how, rather than letting a material cool and all these different points of crystallisation happening, creating these grain boundaries, Rolls-Royce actually have a way of growing a whole jet engine blade. These things are like, they can be up to, I think, a couple of foot tall and, and a foot wide. They can grow it all out of a single crystal. So rather than having this problem where, oh, well, you know, our crystal structure is really good, but actually it's not all the same crystal structure and it's all like a bit higgledy-piggledy, it's like, nah, we've got no faults in this structure. This is genuinely as strong as it should be on the tin, if you see what I mean.
So is that then the structure they make, is that symmetrical?
So theoretically all the planes of atoms in that structure are perfectly symmetrical, give and take a bit of, like, complicated metallurgy.
But, you know, normally when it's not, you know, made in the, you know, high-powered, super labs of Rolls-Royce, it's when they sort of combine that's when you get the asymmetry that you wouldn't be necessarily like wanting or expecting.
Yeah, so basically everything you get that hasn't been massively over-engineered, the properties will never be quite the same in any given direction unless a lot of work's gone into it, because we just can't... You can't account for stuff happening, really, and the an atom moves here, an atom moves there, and actually it has a really big effect on how your material works.
You tend to be thinking more about symmetry, I assume, in life, but I think we've just highlighted the fact that asymmetry can be, you know, just as crucial, if not maybe more important. I just hope that you found that quite interesting and that you've all taken something home today. And hopefully you realise that across the sciences, there are a lot of things in common. You know, there's a lot of talk between, oh, you know, which is the real science, biology versus chemistry versus physics. That's always going to be a debate. But here, I think we've demonstrated that there is a lot of things in common between the three, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if you'd like to find out more, please find us on Facebook and Twitter. So we are The Science Show from the University Radio Nottingham. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Say thank you, Jamie.
Thank you.